Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University, and we have a topic today that we are excited to finally discuss openly with everybody, all our listeners. And we have a graduate student, Dan Marina, is with us, and he's going to tell us about his project here in a little while, and we've delivered this at a few conferences so far. And Dan, you were even on an episode of Gamekeepers with Mossy Oak.
Yep, Mossy Oak Gamekeepers.
I should say Mossy Oak Gamekeepers on this topic. So we wanted to make sure that it was delivered via the podcast. And Dan, you're going to be leaving us here in a week or two. You're headed to Montana.
Yes,
to work
sir.
On a PhD. So we're going to miss you, of course, but we're happy for you as you go forward. So Steve, let's get going here on a topic near and dear to our heart that we have devoted collectively 40 plus years thinking about, and that's antlers, variation in antlers, why bucks have antlers, constantly correcting people that antlers are not horns, even though we hear people say that all the time. Look at the size of the horns, they're not horns, they're antlers, very different structure. So why don't we start there? Why don't we start with Steve? You're a wildlife ecologist and a deer biologist. What's the purpose of antlers? Why do bucks grow these very expensive structures on their head every year?
Well, and the key to understanding the why, or the reason it's so important to understand why, is, you know, they are such a nutritionally demanding investment every year. They put so much of their energy, their nutrients, into growing them. They use them for a few months, and then they drop them off and lose all those nutrients. So there has to be a reason, an important ecological reason.
A compelling reason.
Yes, absolutely, to invest all those resources. And the most obvious is that they're used as a weapon. And for male-to-male combat, fighting for the larger issue of dominance. Who's in charge? And clearly, they are a weapon. Most anybody that's spent enough time in the deer woods during the hunting season, which oftentimes coincides with the breeding season, have seen two bucks at least clink antlers. And sometimes they just, one buck will walk up to another and just, you know, puff up their hair and express their antlers and kind of show what they've got. And sometimes it's just the visual expression of my antlers are bigger than yours, my body's bigger than yours. And sometimes that's enough for the dominance. But when it comes right down to it, if you have similar size, similar aged deer, you're going to end up in a fight. And so it's that weapon that is so critical in determining who's the boss, who's the dominant male, and that sets up who gets to do the breeding when breeding is allowed by the receptive female. And so, ecologically, the main driver historically in the literature and behaviorists that have studied it said, you know, it's all about weapons and male-to-male combat and fighting and getting access to the female. But then there's the third possible, you know, and the dominance has kind of the two subparts, is the expression of the boss without fighting so that you can avoid fighting, because there's no good reason to fight if you can get away with just showing off and not having to fight. That way you avoid injury. But oftentimes you do have to fight, and so that's the second reason. And those are significant, clear motivations behind having antlers. But then there's the third, is that female preference. And does she have if she looks at a buck based on his antler size, can she say with some confidence or think that buck would be a good dad for my children?
So let's go there. let me recap something, Steve. So they're no question about it, they're a weapon. Everybody that's around deer, hunted deer, they can see that. They are used to engage in a fight, and the result of that fight is usually a clear winner and dominance hierarchy, breeding opportunities, etc. They can also be used as a signal, like you mentioned, to avoid the fight. So I like to think of you know, a human example would be kind of like you mentioned, a deer will puff up. Two guys, if they're thinking about quarreling or sparring, they usually puff up their chest. You want to look bigger than maybe you are. And then also, as you see in the movies, I know you've never done this, Steve, but someone may actually show a weapon. So think of any type of action movie, and you know, when some guy and they're preparing to fight and the guy pulls the coat back and you see the gun tucked in the in the side or in his pocket or something, it's like, ooh, this is serious business. You got
talking
a gun.
Dundee, right?
Yeah.
Call that a knife? No, this is a knife.
So that's one of those things for antlers. So in that case, to a male, the antlers are typically saying, I'm a full-grown man, or I'm relatively larger than you. Because typically, there's a pretty solid correlation between antler size and body size. So it's kind of that confirmation signal that buck is bigger and or older and or greater experience. So I think everybody in the deer world completely agrees on them being a solid reference point and signal. But what you brought up, Steve, that we've debated about is, could it also be a signal for a female? Let's talk about real quickly, why would that even be important? Why would a female, why would it matter to her the quality, status, size of a potential mate?
Well, it's critical because just like the buck is investing all these nutrition resources into growing the antlers for 3 months, that's nothing compared to what the female is investing. She is investing an entire year of her life, all of her excess nutritional resources, to growing a fetus for 7 months internally and then supporting that young fawn or fawns on the ground through lactation for, you know, 3 or maybe even 4 months. So, you know, it's a huge investment. It's an entire year of her life, and all of her genetic potential is going to be expressed in those fawns. And so she, ecologically speaking, from an evolutionary standpoint, she needs to do the best she can with that genetic material that she's investing in. So why shouldn't she do the best she can in terms of finding a father?
Yeah, and you know, in the biology lingo and ecology lingo, you call that parental care. And so the father, as with a lot of mammals, unfortunately, is simply a sperm donor. Mm-hmm. They have the act, and then they're completely out of the scene, which is a lot different from some other animals like birds. You know, the father may actually provide parental care, but that's what we started thinking about with deer, is that this mating decision is so important because she has this one event, or maybe several events, copulations. And in terms of her fitness, in terms of perpetuating her genes, then the father could be really, really important. And that's kind of what got us thinking, Steve, 5, 6, 7 plus years ago, was what if?
Yeah. And that's, you know, we've never been shy about disagreeing on things. And it's been kind of a fun discussion we've had over the years about the importance of female choice. And I have to admit that I kind of poo-pooed the idea early on with, you know, you and Randy DeYoung, our MSU Deer Lab friend down at Texas A&M Kingsville, the two of you were just saying, look, female choice has to matter.
It makes all the difference in the world for her to select the appropriate mate.
And I just kind of poo-pooed that for many years. Mm-hmm. That, well, she's going to breed who's dominant behind her when she's in standing estrus. It doesn't matter. There's no female choice in white-tailed deer.
And so we could kind of, how we've kind of resolved that over the years, Steve, is we kind of referred to that maybe as passive selection. By default, the buck that is able to breed her has likely run the gauntlet of different fights. You know, maybe he is, because he's the one there, he's the one standing, and he's the only one available at that time. Maybe he is dominant, mm-hmm. simply because he's there. But then we started thinking, but what if a female, if she had a choice, if she could choose between two different males? And then that brought us into the whole issue of, is she selecting for body size? Is she selecting for age and or experience? Or is she looking at the headgear? Is she looking at the ornament that's on top of his head? And is that a cue to a female?
Yeah. And one of the key pieces of literature that got me excited was some work with mice, where they did this experiment where they had two male mice in separate cages, and then a female that would be have access to both of the outside of both of those males' cages, and they documented which male she seems to prefer based on the time she spent next to that male's cage. And then they did this interesting study where they allowed females to breed their preferred mates. Half of the females got to do that, and then the other half got stuck breeding the non-preferred male. And the results were pretty eye-opening in that the offspring of the matings with the preferred male were more successful than the offspring that where the female had to breed her non-preferred male. And that was like really eye-opening for me.
Yeah, she knew something was going on.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay, but this isn't really the male I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a huge question ecologically, and then logistically it's so difficult because, as you mentioned, you know, is it body size? Is it age? Is it antler size? You know, all those things are autocorrelated. When a buck gets older, his body gets bigger and his antlers get larger. And so, you know, some deer scientists over across the pond in Europe have talked about this and looked at it as a question before, but they had trouble resolving the question because of the autocorrelation. And so we had to come up with a really unique study design and wait for the opportunity to have funding to do the study.
Mm-hmm.
And that opportunity came about with our state agency needing to document fetal growth rates for deer in Mississippi. And so we had to control breeding and using, well, we'll let Dan describe how we controlled the breeding, but we needed to control breeding. And we had this opportunity for an individual female to be bred at a certain time, and therefore we knew she was in estrus. And so we thought, well, maybe this is the chance to test this hypothesis, this ecological concept.
Right. We know when she's in heat, that's the time where if she was ever going to make a choice, that would be the time she would make a choice.
That's right. But it was a hugely demanding project. And you and I couldn't have done it.
No, absolutely not.
We had the idea and the logistics, but we had to bring in somebody that could really do it.
Had more mechanically inclined, hands-on type experience.
And could improvise and fix things that we messed up. And just really, you know, I've often said to my graduate students that, you know, if anybody could have done this project, I wouldn't have hired you for it. But that's on steroids with this particular project.
Right.
Because the average student that I've had over the years couldn't have done this project either. It required a special set of skills and motivation. And that's why we brought in Dan.
Yeah, luckily I had that construction background for 7 years, and this project definitely required a lot of those skills. I think I used my electrical skills, running power for cameras, and just in general attaching the antlers, which we'll get into here in a little bit too.
Give everybody a little background, where you're from, what you did before you came to Mississippi State.
Okay, so yeah, I'm actually from North Carolina, and before I got into wildlife, I was in construction management for 7 years, five of it with a company, a general contractor, where I ran all of our projects. It was commercial renovations, commercial construction in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. And so, you know, we did everything from roofing, replacing siding, repainting, redoing the interiors, building new clubhouses, different things like that. So, did that for, like I say, 7 years in that industry, and got my feet wet in pretty much every type of trade that was ongoing on our projects.
So. You probably made pretty good money on that too, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't come back to wildlife to make better money for sure.
So,
but you know, I came back because I was more interested in the wildlife, and I felt like, you know, it's just like the old saying goes, if you do what you love, you don't work a day in your life. So that's kind of what I was after.
Yeah. So you left construction and actually had to work on a bachelor's degree?
Yes. Yeah, I did my bachelor's degree at NC State University. While having, at that point, I already had two children, and added a third child during that bachelor's degree. But I finished that up in end of 2014, and then I was lucky enough to get hired on with y'all here in 2015 and added one more child to the mix.
As if life wasn't complicated enough.
Yeah, you know, part of the project, it was kind of funny, part of that project, we were, you know, breeding deer at specific times, and to answer the state agency's question, we are actually scheduling C-sections to sample fetuses, and I joked with Dr. Damaris at the end of my first field season, as we were setting up scheduling C-sections for the spring, I said, "Doc, I added one more C-section to the mix." He's like, where'd you get another deer? And I said, "No, it's not a deer. It's actually mine. It's my wife."
That's being all in a project right there.
Yeah.
That's going the extra mile.
Yes.
Yeah. So what were the key logistical issues that we had to address in this project, Dan?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the answer to the state agency question, we needed to have deer in estrus at specific times and breed them in specific dates. And so that's what allowed us to get into this question about the female choice and to be able to do some choice trials while they were in estrus. We were using the CEDAR devices, or a controlled internal drug release, that they use in cows, and they use it in sheep. We were actually using sheep cedars for those deer. You insert the device, 2 weeks later you remove it, and within 24 hours that female is coming into estrus, and then they ovulate about 60 hours later. So we had that timing down. So as soon as we removed that estrus, we had to have a female into a choice trial, which we set up. And so the logistics of that were difficult because we needed to make sure we didn't have more than one female coming into estrus at a time in order to have them all be able to run through these trials. Because our facilities were such that we had enough room to have one ongoing trial happening, and those trials were 36 hours long. So you couldn't have all the deer coming into estrus at the same time like they would normally do, or you know, a lot of them would be coming in together at the same time and during the normal breeding season. So being able to control with those CEDAR devices and space them out one every 2 days, you know, that was our main logistical issue coming into it, is to schedule each female. And not to push them so far off that we were not within their normal range of breeding. As you remember, like when we first were meeting, we actually went into the previous breeding history of a lot of the females we had in the pens, and we were like, all right, this is when she normally bred, so we need to try to accommodate it, you know, within a couple of weeks of when that timing is. We didn't want to push them out of their normal range,
yeah,
you know, too far.
Yeah.
So
a lot of logistical work on the female. What about the whole idea of these autocorrelated features in the male and how we could tease those apart in an experiment?
Right. So that's where, coming into it, I mean, y'all had done a lot of the legwork in that, right? There was in order to really isolate the antlers, you had to control for the body size and age, which means you needed to have two males that were the same age, same body size, but one with really large antlers and one with really small antlers. And as you know, most people would expect, you're not going to find a setup like that. You're not going to find two males that are the same age, same body size, with a huge difference in antler size, because of that autocorrelation. So y'all had already kind of worked out that somewhat, or at least I thought it was completely worked out when I got here. Y'all had done some previous stuff with PVC pipe attaching antlers to, you know, cutting off their normal antlers and attaching different size antlers with PVC pipe. And obviously you mentioned that didn't work, and then had these metal coupling devices that were devised right before I got here. But when I showed up, we had to work on making sure that those were able to be attached securely, and that those bucks, when they're running around, they rub on trees during that time period. They're rubbing the velvet off, so their natural instinct is to be rubbing on things, fighting other males, and so we needed to make sure they were very secure so they didn't come loose, during trials.
Yeah. Refer back to your construction experience.
Yes.
It was kind of like that. Really helped that part of the project.
It did. Because, when we first started in and started installing those couplers, we tried what we had thought was going to work. We actually used just some screws into that bone, because people screw into bones. I mean, when you get something replaced in your leg, even, they put plates in, they use bone screws, but we obviously don't do the type of put as much stress on those places as these males do with their antlers. And so the first set of antlers we actually installed, we just used the screws three different positions around the circumference of that antler base, and they were able to work them loose by constantly rubbing on the fences and rubbing on trees. And so we had to change kind of mid installation of these things. We had to change up the method of how we were doing them, and so that's when we switched over to a through bolt, drilling a pilot hole all the way through the antler base, perpendicular to each other, and using through bolts to really strengthen that fastening point. It wound up working out really well that way. So we installed those base couplers that way, and when they were on their head, we actually had a male break a tine off of the set of antlers we gave him. It didn't come loose on the bases, it just broke that tine off. So we got something that was very strong in the end, and I think we could use it for a lot of different size antler bases with that.
Yeah, and so that allowed us to, for the same buck, put on a big antler set 1 week, 2 weeks later, sedate them, take those off, and put on a small set of antlers.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, well, let's go ahead and get into how we tested the female choice of those antlers. So these males, we used these base couplers and we installed them on their antler bases that we left about an inch of their normal antler base, cut off their natural antlers, and bolted on those base couplers. And then we installed either a large set of antlers or a small set of antlers on a pair of bucks that we had paired up, that they were the same age and the same body size. So we
give an approximate Boone and Crockett score so people know the difference.
Okay, so I think the approximate Boone and Crockett score for the small antlers were about 82 inches and about 165 for the larger antlers. So pretty big difference in size.
I mean, clear difference.
Very
for
clear.
For a doe looking at a buck, clear difference.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I mean, and typically that would be she's looking at a yearling versus she's looking at a 5 or 6 year old, right? But these are the same age males and the same body size, because and just having those two different antler sizes. So we placed them on into holding pens, and these holding pens are about a, what size are those holding pens? About a tenth of an acre. Yeah, so they're large enough for them to move around in, but they're not too large where they wouldn't be in contact with the female. So we placed them in these holding pens on either side of a center holding pen. And you know, the large male may be on the left and the small male on the right. And we would send these females, as I mentioned, we would pull those cedars. 24 hours later, the females would go into estrus. So we'd pull the cedar out of a female. She'd be in another holding pen, kind of in waiting for 24 hours. And then after that 24-hour period, we'd move her into that center holding pen. And so this is where we had cameras facing down both fence lines. And those, you know, back to the construction skills, there were no cameras when I got there. We had to run electrical outlets, and we actually installed what it was a security system cameras, FLIR infrared cameras facing down each fence line that recorded the video back to a DVR wirelessly, a really neat system. And so these cameras were there to monitor, you know, kind of the activities of what this female was doing during these trials. So we'd send her into the trial. She'd have one male on one side of her pen, and she'd have another male on the other. She could see into these pens, but they could not access her. And the reason for that is because we also needed to control for that intersexual competition, or the fighting, right?
Right.
We didn't want those males to be able to fight and that female be able to see who was the dominant male. We were trying to make it so that she had to use the only thing we gave her that was different. Since both were the same body size and same age, the only thing she could look at were those antlers. Mm-hmm. And so for that 36 hours she was in the trial, we recorded her behaviors in that pen, and we were only looking at what she was doing within 10 feet of each fence line, shared with either the large antlered male or the small antlered male. And we looked for three main things. Two main things that we looked at for, you know, were the amount of time she spent was the amount of time she spent walking up and down each fence line, and she'd walk up and down that fence line kind of checking out each male, and sometimes he'd come up to the fence line with her, and sometimes he'd be kind of just laying down. The other thing we were looking at time-wise was the amount of time she spent bedded next to one male or the other. And that's because, you know, through previous work done in the pens, we had seen that the males that were dominant and were breeding these females, the females would actually bed near them in those videos that were recorded before I'd gotten here. So we tried to use that as a criteria to help establish whether she was choosing one or the other. And then the final thing we were looking at was not a timing component, but more of a how many times did this behavior occur. And that was, we were looking for like a specific, something specific this female was doing that said to us, she's making a choice for that male or the other. For that, we were really looking for standing. We were wanting her to stand to that fence and, you know, kind of waiting along like, all right, you know, come on and breed me. And that's what we were looking for, is that standing estrus. And we had that happen in a few of the trials. It didn't happen. We didn't see these behaviors in every single trial. But it did. It happened in enough of them and enough times that it was obvious to us that particular female was making a choice. So we recorded all this information for each trial. And as I mentioned, we would send these females in. We did seven females with that first setup. So we had the large antlered male on one side, small antler on the other. We sent seven females in at separate times, and each female got to make a choice and then was sent out. And then after we finished those seven females, we wanted to make sure that there wasn't, you know, like we might be sending these females in and, you know, that side that's next to the large antler male may have just been the side of the pen that all the females liked hanging out on. There was some nice, you know, soft ground over there or something that they just liked laying on or liked, you know, walking near. And so
the view was better.
The view was better. Yeah. I don't know. Well, the view may have been better.
Right.
The antlers. So to really make sure that there was not a pen effect, after those first seven trials, we actually took the larger antlered male and we moved him to the other side. And then we swapped those males so that now, if there was a really nice spot for deer to, you know, for the females to lay, she'd be laying next to the small antlered male instead of the large. And so we ran those seven trials. And again, I don't know if this is spoiler alert, but they definitely shifted their side to the side with the larger antlered males for the majority of the time. And then the final switch that we did after another seven trials was we wanted to make sure that, okay, she's choosing those large antlers. But what if there's something else about that buck that's wearing them? That, you know, maybe she's choosing him for another reason and it's not the antlers. So if we give him the small antlers, if that was the case, she should still choose him, right?
Right.
But if she's choosing the large antlers, she should follow the antlers. And so at that time, we actually swapped the antlers. We took the male that had the large antlers, now got small antlers, and he didn't get just that same exact set of small antlers. He got a new set of small antlers to make sure that it was just a different set that she was looking at. Same thing with the one that the small antlered male was wearing, the small antlers. Now he got to wear it, be the big one. You know, he got to be the larger antlered male, and he got a new set of larger antlers. And we used a different set to make sure it wasn't something of, you know, the shape or the just something very specific about that set of antlers. It was the large antlers.
Right.
That's what she was choosing. And so then we ran another 7 trials with those antlers swapped. And at that point, we felt we had enough trials and enough data collected to, you know, make a decision on who they were choosing. But we didn't stop there. We actually wanted to say, all right, well, and I didn't mention, but the males we started out with were 6-year-old males. So they're mature males. We wanted to see if this would also happen if we used younger males, you know. So we actually installed those 165-inch, you know, on average, Boone and Crockett score antlers on a yearling. And we did 2 yearlings that were the same age, obviously, same body size. One got the large antlers, one got the small antlers. And we were able to get 5 trials in with them. But the funny thing, funny or not, it was interesting that when he wore them, we had to actually give him a day or two to get used to wearing those antlers. Because that's a lot larger headgear than he was used to running around with.
Absolutely.
Prior
Big
to that.
Change.
So took him a day or two to get used to wearing those antlers. They were a little heavier. And then once he got used to them, we started setting the females in. And we did 5 trials that way, or 5 females were able to make a choice between those 2 yearlings. But we didn't get to fully do the swapping like we did with the larger males, because after 5 trials, that male was rubbing on the fence and broke the antlers off. Turns out his little 3/4-inch, you know, certain diameter antler bases were just not strong enough to hold those larger antlers, and so it actually wasn't the antler coupling device that failed, but actually the integrity of the foundation, his antler base. And it didn't help as much that, you know, when we had to install these, we were drilling through, so that obviously weakened the structural integrity of his antler base as well. So, but that helped us kind of learn that, you know, in the future, if anybody else is going to be manipulating antlers, probably need to, there is a size that's probably too small or too large of an antler to go on a certain size antler base. And we didn't exactly figure out what that line is, but we know that probably yearlings are not a good candidate for these trials,
right,
for antler manipulation. But yeah, they worked out very well. And you know, to get into what we found, across the board, 80% of those females chose larger antler males over smaller antler males. And that was 80% of the females, you know, according to the amount of time spent walking, amount of time spent bedded, and as well as those behaviors that indicated choice.
So antlers matter.
So antlers do matter, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And antler size matters.
Antler size absolutely mattered to these females. I mean, especially, you know, when we get into we further went on to try to look at the body size, and we controlled for antlers. We just didn't allow them to have antlers at all, and we followed up these trials with more trials looking at body size and looking at that age. And, you know, when we look at the results of those, it was a coin flip as to which male the female would choose based on body size and age. So that was really strong to us that it's antlers. It's not anything else that, as far as we can tell, that we've tested. It's antlers that they're choosing.
So, Steve, why would that be a reliable signal to a female that he's a quality father?
Well, it is the most obvious secondary sexual characteristic. You know, the primary sexual characteristics are the genitals, the testicles.
And he's a male.
Yeah, he's a male. Antlers are a secondary sexual characteristic that is his expression of his maleness at sexual maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, an important time or characteristic that the female wants to key in on or needs to key in on, is not just that he's a male, but he's a male with good genetic potential.
And that was demonstrated, Dan, was it with roe deer? The paper where I remember the title of antlers are an honest signal
right.
of genetic quality. And I can't remember their metric for genetic quality, if that was fitness and reproduction or longevity, they lived a long time or whatever. But
I think it was several factors, yeah, that okay. you mentioned.
So they more or less confirmed that antlers were correlated, highly correlated to those characteristics. So we assume the same occurs yeah. in white-tailed deer.
Yeah, and our friend Steve Ditchkoff at Auburn has done some work looking at genetic characteristics and a particular set of genes that tie back to the immune capacity of the animal. There's more immunocapacity for bucks with larger antlers. So that kind of back to that. Larger antlers signify genetic superiority over some smaller antlers.
Right, right. So that brings us, as when we were looking at the results, and Steve, as I said numerous times, I told you so.
Yes.
Yeah, just...
Yeah, and
the
yeah,
humble
we
pie
want to clarify that,
you.
That yeah. yes, that you and Randy were right.
That's right.
You were right. Now, in my own self-defense, it still mostly matters that they are weapons and the whole dominance thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we've shown, Dan has shown, without a doubt, clearly antler size matters to the female too.
And that's, when she has a choice.
When she has a choice. And that was, I mean, literally, this is the first time this has ever been done in the world. Scientists like you and I have been working with deer and deer antlers, you know, Europeans, Asians, Australians, a lot of work on deer antlers and why antlers exist and all this behavioral stuff. But in 70 or 80 years of antler research, nobody's ever been able to successfully break that nut open mm-hmm. and prove it one way or the other.
Yeah. It was a tough hill to climb, just the logistics of manipulating the antlers. That's what made it so hard. So some of the previous work, I mean, other researchers, specifically in Europe with red deer, the ones off the top of my head, is typically they would look at the antlers being removed or the antler size being diminished greatly, but those animals were still interacting with other males, and that's what complicated it. So for a simple example, if you had a red deer stag and he's the harem bull, and you go cut his antlers off or greatly reduce them, he can no longer defend himself among other stags, and obviously then his reproductive success
yeah.
goes to zero. That was what was different. People, this question has been, I mean, Darwin wrote about antlers, you know, so this is a long, long, interesting question. I guess it's now just the technology and capability we have and having Dan.
We had to wait on Dan.
We had to wait on Dan to come. Okay, so we know, so here's the things we know. We know antlers are a weapon. We know that antlers are a signal to other males. We also know now antlers are a signal of quality to females. What's the total manifestation of this now? Is how often does a female get to make a choice? So we're getting back, Steve, to the active versus passive. And I'm touching on what you said a moment ago. You still think most of the time these choices by females are made passively because the buck that is behind her is the one that won.
Yeah.
He's the one that's dominant. He, through the trials and tribulations, has availed himself to be the one to breed. So is this an academic exercise that we found out this curiosity that females do choose antlers, or do you think it ever comes into actual play in the wild?
Well, two points I'll make. First off is there is literally no practical application to this research.
As far as management, there's no management implications.
You know, you can't take this out and change your management approach because of this new information. It's really cool and exciting, and literally the first, you know, successful testing of this theory in the world. And so we're really excited and proud that we did it. But there's no management application. However, if it matters to a female, how might she implement that preference? And Dan has developed some interesting hypotheses.
Yeah. Okay. So looking through the literature, I mean, we found this and we're like, okay, great. These females choose the larger antler male. But how could she ever make that choice matter, right? As Dr. Damaris had mentioned, you know, if whoever wins and standing behind her is probably going to get to breed her. But as I dug through the literature, there was a new study that had just come out last year out of the Auburn Deer Lab as well, where they were following movements of females throughout the breeding season. They you know, prior to breeding season and then through breeding season and on out. And what they found was that some of those females were making excursion movements just prior to estrus. So right before estrus was about to start, they were out moving around making these an excursion. For anyone who is not familiar, it's just a very long movement outside the typical home range of that female.
Yeah, short-term movement.
Yeah, short-term movement. She came right back. But the interesting thing is they kind of proposed that those movements were those females going out and seeking out mates just prior to coming into estrus. They wanted to see what was out there. That's kind of what they proposed. They don't, you know, there's no direct evidence of that. But when I combine that with some other interesting literature I found that showed that larger antlered males, well, actually this literature showed that larger antlered, larger bodied, older males can have a biostimulatory effect on females, meaning they can cause them to come into estrus sooner than they would naturally, which is interesting. Because if these females are, you know, if that study was correct and they were making these excursions to go out and look for higher quality mates, and then they get around that larger antlered male and he's able to, you know, biostimulate her to come into estrus, that, you know, that exact scenario would have to work out, which obviously would not happen most of the time. But if it happens just even 0.5% of the time over the evolutionary time period of antler development, you know, that would have an effect on the size of the antlers that these males are growing. The interesting thing about those studies, as I mentioned, they said that larger antlered males, larger body size males, and older males were the ones. They don't know. Actually, we're looking at it now saying maybe there was an autocorrelation issue in those studies. Maybe it was only antler size that was driving that biostimulation, but they didn't have the means of this antler manipulation process to kind of isolate the traits to see which one was causing the biostimulation. But anyway, you put those two things together, and that could be how these females make their choice matter if they get to in you know, very limited amount of, you know, circumstances.
So one of the interesting things to me, Bronson and Dan, is, you know, if you have this male-to-male combat that's providing this directional stimulus for antler size, and you have these females that clearly are expressing a preference for larger antlers, why don't antlers just get larger and larger and larger?
That's that would be runaway selection, would be one name for that. And the very obvious answer is at some point antlers become too expensive physiologically, so there's not enough return on that physiological investment. And it becomes a disadvantage. So real simply, you could see that, the yearling buck example. At some point, antlers become too big and too expensive to grow them and to haul around. They become a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So obviously, there's going to be some type of sweet spot. There's going to be an optimization. And there's going to be variation around that depending on the individual and year to year and place to place. But there's kind of an optimal antler size, an antler phenotype that probably works out best.
And you've done some interesting, you've provided the leadership on some interesting research looking at, you know, the hundreds of thousands of data points of antlers that we have and body weights for deer across Mississippi and elsewhere. And that's probably deserves a full podcast, yeah. But how about just a elevator?
You want a sneak peek?
Yeah, let's talk.
Sneak peek. Okay, the couple things that are important that are very interesting. Number one is that larger bucks, larger bodied bucks produce larger antlers in terms of absolute size. Mm-hmm. A bigger body means you have a bigger skeletal system and likely have greater food resources available to you, and therefore you grow larger antlers that correspond with it. What is interesting, though, is that the ratio of antler to body within Mississippi, and we have a drastic disparity in body size and antler size in the regions of Mississippi, the ratio of antler size to body size is identical at maturity. So I admit I'm wrong here, Steve, and you're not going to hear that very often.
Because it's rare that you are wrong.
Yeah. I went into that thinking that they were going to be absolutely larger and relatively larger. That was my hypothesis when we were looking at our Delta region and our Ag region, that, yeah, we know that the antlers are bigger. Of course they are. I thought they were going to be relatively bigger. I thought Delta deer, bucks were going to be able to allocate more energy because they could, mm-hmm. abundant food. But what we found out is bucks from the Delta, the Ag region, they start out being able to allocate a little bit more. They come out of the gate having relatively larger antlers. But once they get to maturity, 5+ years of age, they allocate the exact same relative amount as deer in other regions. And so that in and of itself tells you there's a diminishing returns aspect. They don't need just to keep growing and growing and growing because now it's disadvantageous to them to do so. And so we kind of ended up with, it goes back, Steve, to something we've covered years and years ago, is an 8-point frame is pretty optimal because about half the bucks at maturity have an 8-point frame. 10 points are more of a novelty. And of course, a 12 or a 14 are very, very rare, but a lot of these bucks are 8 points because Mother Nature and time has said that's a pretty reliable investment to have that type of frame. Another sneak peek we saw is at what point does antler size begin the diminishing returns? And I didn't look at number of tines and tine length, I only looked at beam length. And when you reach a threshold of about 22 inches, that is when they start allocating less and less and less. So it's almost like they keep allocating, keep growing until they get to be 21, 22, 23. And then the relationship between body size and beam length goes away. The bigger they get, they just don't keep on growing those beams longer and the antlers bigger. They have reached a sufficient size to where it is better, and this makes perfect sense, it would be better for that buck now that he has a reliable weapon, a reliable signal to a female and to other males, it's probably better rather than over-investing in antlers to invest back into your body so that you can fight longer and live longer than throwing them into this annual headgear.
Yeah, the physics suggest leverage is important in fighting, and that 22-inch beam length gives the buck the leverage he needs.
That's right.
And our former construction guy over here knows about leverage and lifting heavy items, mm-hmm. fighting another male. Leverage is critical.
Yeah, I mean, so you can see easily antlers too big or too wide. Mm. When you're engaging head-to-head with a normal 8-point average 23-inch beam, 16 inches inside, you could be in a disadvantage. If your antlers were too big, you might have this wonderful signal to a female, but when it came down to the fight, you would lose.
Right.
Yeah.
So would we be safe to say that the presence of those larger antlers that are above that kind of threshold may be in part due to this female choice? I mean, that's still kind of affecting it slightly over a longer time period?
I don't know if I can answer that.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Maybe it's driving some of it. Maybe there's some, maybe there is some novelty, some bling that goes along. Hey, I've to be able to compete, I've got to be 130 inches, you know. But then maybe if I'm 145 or 150, I can still compete with other males. I've got another little bling. I can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's enough food resources I can afford it. And maybe that is one of those, like the peacock's tail, is a demonstration of phenotypic quality.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, Dan specifically tested antler size. It would be fun sometime in the future to test some bling characteristics,
yeah.
Not just size, but non-typical points. Why do they exist? Is there a female preference for trash?
Yeah, we've talked about this. I've had conversations with this. A lot of people ask me when we tell them about this study. They're like, "Well, did you look and see if females prefer non-typical or typical males over non-typical males or anything like that?" And I said, "No, you know, but if you're willing to give some money, we can run some more trials. But it would be interesting to know." Because, you know, we hear it all the time, especially scoring antlers. You know, you're deducting points for some of these different pieces these antlers are growing.
Yeah, for the non-symmetry.
Correct, yeah, non-symmetry.
Boone and Crockett criteria.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, should we be knocking them for those points? Maybe the females like them. Maybe it's chosen more than just because it makes them look bigger. Who knows? But I think it'd be something interesting to look at and find out.
Yeah, the adaptive significance of the drop tine.
Ooh.
Wouldn't that be cool? Well, guys, I think we've covered the topic pretty well. Anything else, Steve or Dan, you want to add to wrap this up?
Well, we're a week away from losing Dan to Montana, so... I'm full of emotions of joy over his success, but sadness over him leaving, but the excitement of looking forward to what he's going to do next.
Yeah, I'm ditto, as well as I'm looking forward to an invitation in about a year to come hunt in Montana with Dan.
Well, if you ever want to talk elk, on the Deer Lab podcast here, I'd be willing to phone in or we can meet somewhere at a conference and we can definitely discuss some, get another deer species into the Mississippi Deer.
Absolutely.
Deer University.
Sounds great. Okay, guys, thank you very much and thanks for tuning in. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service, and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.